Nothing's coming through.
And let's go here on start.
Ah. How about now?
So we got our mic. Good.
Good evening, friends of the Bulkley Valley and beyond. My name is Thomas Tom Roper, and you are listening to CICK, Smithers Community Radio, 93.9 on your FM dial. My program, On the Ropes, is broadcasting from the Cassia territory of the Gidimdum clan, home of the Wet'suwet'en.
Okay, Toby, there we are. And we are now live on CICK radio, and we're going to have an introduction of one of our interviewees, Toby Walsh. Can you say hi to us, Toby?
Hi, Radioland.
Okay, all right. I don't sound like I'm not getting any volume, but we are getting recording here, so we'll just have to run with what we got happening.
Okay.
All right. So we'll make the best of the program. So tonight, some of you out in Radioland may remember Toby from years ago. He's the fella that built the shoe house out on Kitsiukla Road. And I'd like to spend a little bit of time talking about that. But after we've got a little bit more information on how Toby got to the Bulkley Valley and what he enjoys about the valley. So let's go back, Toby, and start at the beginning. It sounded to me like you were born in San Francisco. Is that true?
Yeah, at the hospital there, but I lived across the bay.
Okay. All right. So you were living like at the penitentiary there at
Yeah, right from birth.
Yeah, right. Right. Devil's Island or whatever they call that there.
Alcatraz there.
So being brought up in San Francisco, this is back in the would be in the early 60s. And at that time it was kind of a mecca for the hippie era.
That was a wonderful time.
Yeah, it was amazing time, amazing time. So you lived through that era. You were at the, you saw the music, you saw what was going on, you met the people.
Well, actually, I was a bit out of it back then. I kind of lived through it, but on the periphery.
Right.
And other people, they were directly involved with that whole movement.
Right,
but
right.
Now and again, I would just by chance find the groups playing in the park.
Right.
And we visited Haight-Ashbury, and it was an eye-opener.
Yeah, yeah, I can imagine it was. Yeah. Hey? So in that period of time, like with all, there was quite a drug revolution. There was a lot going on. We had the Vietnam War. Were you, how did you make out through that situation?
I tried to stay out of it.
Right.
It just didn't look like a good idea.
Right, right.
And so if you were in college or university, you got a deferment.
Oh, I see.
And so I just kept on getting deferment. And I was hoping that the war was going to end soon. But I ended up getting deferments for 7 years.
Wow.
And I couldn't stretch it any further.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So at that time, then, you were taking courses at the university.
Yeah, San Jose State. Dirt cheap to go there. $79 a semester.
Wow.
I know. I mean, you didn't go into debt going to university.
Yeah,
back
yeah
then.
It's a completely different world today.
Oh, yeah, it was good. Yeah.
Very, very difficult world cost-wise, for sure.
So one semester I took camping, and that
camping
was,
101?
Yes.
Okay.
And that was how to camp out there. Another one was scuba diving.
Right.
And another course was storytelling. And another one was how to look at movies.
Right, right. Interesting.
Well, I thought that's kind of what university should be.
Yeah. It's kind of a...
And I was amazed at people that could go in 4 years later, they had their degree and exited. I couldn't understand how they could make up their mind, stick to it, and not be wooed by all the other things that were being offered.
Right, right. So there was so much variety that you, would, if you were taking a program, like say you were going to go into science or something, there would still be room for a couple of electives.
Oh, lots.
Yeah. So you could still have a
and
little bit of fun.
And if you wanted to go another extra year, it was only $79.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So at the end of this 7-year period, were your parents interested in kicking you out of the house and getting you on with something?
Well, I was paying my own way.
Right, right. So that wasn't a cost.
Hard to say what they thought.
Yeah.
I think they figured I wasn't taking life too seriously.
Right.
Anyway, I got drafted, and so I didn't want to go into the war. But I did have to go down to the induction center. And so if I didn't take a step forward, that was a federal offense. And a step forward would be saying, yes, I want to be in the military.
Right.
But if I didn't go to the induction center for that, that was another federal offense.
I see.
So I committed a federal offense. And they threatened me with 5 years in prison and a $10,000 fine.
Wow, wow.
And that was because I didn't want to go kill anybody.
Right, right. And there was no room for that war situation at that time.
Wasn't. Now, McNamara, I think he was Secretary of Defense, or later he said the whole Vietnam War was a mistake.
Right.
Well, I kind of came to that conclusion well before he did.
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting how that would come about, you
yes,
know.
Yes, I know.
So at that time, then, you were facing imprisonment. How did you deal with that? What was the next step?
I saw a number of lawyers, and the best one, he defended David Harris, who was married to Joan Baez at the time, and he was the first one that burned his draft card.
Right, right.
And so this lawyer, he didn't know if the government was going to come down and scoop him.
Right.
So he had a briefcase with $100,000 in it, which was a lot of money back then.
Right.
And he had his sailboat out around Santa Cruz off the coast, and he could drive there in an hour and be gone.
Right.
So it was that kind of time. I mean, just didn't know what your your future was waiting for you was.
It's a hugely interesting time, and I get the feeling today that we're sort of encroaching on that style of control.
There's a lot of uncertainty nowadays, and there was a lot of uncertainty then. And with the draft, it depends upon where they put you, but it was certain death.
Right, right. Yeah, it wasn't a good situation. So then... So you went, I'm just trying to find how you were able to come to Canada. Was that part of that process?
Well, yeah, my lawyer, he said they goofed up. And a federal judge in San Francisco said, you know, they have to correct their error. He says, don't flee because that's what they're hoping.
Right.
Just sit tight. It'll all work itself out. And then... you'll be free to go.
Right, right.
And so at the meantime, I was working for a department store. I was a Santa there.
You were a witch?
A Santa.
Oh, yeah.
And Santa in the States comes 2 months early.
Oh, I see.
And so I did that, and I found 5 kids that could see auras. And that was kind of what I was interested in at the time. And so I'd ask these kids, could you see rainbow colors around you or around other people? And like if I was wearing blue and white, you know, I would say, well, what do you see around me? And if they said blue and white, well, that was, I didn't think they could see it. But if they said green and red, then they probably did see the colors.
Right.
And I had read that the colors go out just about 6 inches away from the body. And so I said, well, how far out do you see the colors? And they said, they showed me, and it was about six inches.
Interesting. So they would be, you'd say that they were sort of an astute child that had some.
Now,
a little
one
bit
kid, he would tell his mom that he saw these colors, and his mom said, they don't exist. And I said to the kid, take it from Santa. your mom is wrong on this one.
Right, right, right. Yeah, right.
So said,
right.
I said, you're very, very special that you can see these colors.
Yeah.
I said, don't tell your mom this. But
yeah, yeah. It's kind of something he's going to live with without getting into.
It's a secret between you and Santa right now.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. So that's a pretty good trade, being a Santa. Like, that was a lot of fun.
And so I met these two women there. They worked at the same department store, and they were headed up to Canada, and they say, you want to come with us? And because I had a chainsaw.
And you had a chainsaw in San Francisco Bay Area?
Now, why I had one, I can't remember why.
Right,
but,
right.
But that was kind of my ticket to ride with them. And so we all drove up in two vehicles, and they knew of a cabin on Hudson Bay Mountain that nobody lived in, and that's where we moved.
So that was their direct line, was San Francisco to Hudson Bay Mountain.
Yeah.
And well, they must have had somebody that they knew there.
There was a woman that worked in the same department store, and her brother lived up here in Smithers.
Oh,
so okay. They flew up. This is well before we drove up.
Right.
They flew up and they met him, and he drove him around, showed him various places they could live for free. And this one cabin up there on the side of Hudson Bay Mountain was one of the places that he showed
him. I see.
And they said, yes, this will work.
Let's try this. Let's try this. Yeah. So then you were able to kind of muck in with these guys because they knew they needed a saw.
Yeah, they were very practical women.
Right, right, right. Yeah, and that because I mean, if we're going to live for free, we're probably going to burn wood that we can get for free.
Yeah.
And if there's a guy that they happen to have met, if it was a Santa Claus, it's even better because he would have
just make your wish. Huh?
Yeah, that sounds pretty cool. Pretty cool. So where would we put this in the time frame? Would this be 1970?
1972.
Okay.
And so the war, I think, was maybe it ended in 1972. But that war went on and on and on.
But it seemed to be catching up with them around 72.
Yeah.
Where
now,
they.
I could leave the United States, and when I talked to after I was up here for a few months, I had to get a work permit, and that meant going to Prince George and talking to an immigration officer.
Right, right.
And I got pushed through the door.
Yeah.
Back then, it was very easy. And
well, in the 70s, they needed workers real bad.
And here I was a graduate.
Yeah.
From university and. So I asked the guy, I said, can they get me up here? And he said, no. You stay in Canada and they can't lay their hands on you.
Right.
So I figured, great, this is where I want to stay.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
And so what about your mom and dad? Like, what were they?
They were less than pleased.
Right, right.
So I'd drive down and see my mom. My dad was dead by this time. And so after going down for, maybe 20 years, my mom finally said, when are you coming back?
Right, right.
And
yeah.
I said, never.
Yeah.
I said, this government down here, they tried to kill me.
Yeah.
And I said, no, Canada's my home. And she looked really sad about this, but she never asked again.
Right, right. And she never thought that she might come up and live with you in Smithers.
I think that was the furthest thing from her mind. She remarried, and the guy she married, do you remember All in the Family with Archie Bunker?
Yeah, I do.
Well, she married Archie Bunker.
Okay.
And her name was Edith.
Right.
So it kind of fit right in with that.
Right, right.
And he and I, we didn't really strike it off. I was like meathead.
Right.
And they came up for our wedding. And that was about it.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
they couldn't get back quick enough back to the Bay Area.
Fast enough.
Yeah.
So when you were going over the border, was there not a complication that you were an American citizen coming back into the States?
Well, I was a landed immigrant by this time in
Canada.
Oh,
I see.
And you didn't need a Canadian passport at that time.
Right.
Yeah, going back and forth, it was pretty easy. But now and again, they would say, were you ever an American citizen?
Right.
I said, yeah. And they said, when did you move up to Canada? And I said, 1972. And the guy starts counting on his fingers, and he was going, ah, the war was still on. He said, come on inside.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
And so they saw that I had resisted the draft, and I said they dropped all the charges. And he said the government doesn't drop those kind of charges. So eventually they saw that I wasn't wanted, but I did have to travel with my FBI file.
Oh, I see.
That showed that they did drop the charges.
Right, right. So you had
But they hassled me for 30, 40 years.
Yeah, yeah. But you had your documentation, so you were able to make it work.
And they didn't like seeing that documentation.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. No, that's something, you know, I don't think they would ever get over, you know.
No, they've got a long memory.
Yeah.
They and really it was do. Almost like the guy was saying, well, why do you hate me? He identified so strongly with the country. And I said, I don't hate you at all.
Yeah, yeah.
I just choose to live in Canada.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and we've and that choice is sort of like, well, I don't want to get involved in killing people that just for an economic gain.
You don't even enter into that because there was no, you just go round and round with
certainly. Okay, Toby, so we've got ourselves up with a couple of young ladies. You've brought your chainsaw with you and you're up on Hudson Bay Mountain.
Yeah.
Now, that's not like living downtown. That's a job to get up there. You got to get to town, get groceries. You got to get your firewood. It's a fair ways up there.
Now you sound just like the other people that would talk to us. They said, "Oh, you have to travel so far." Living in the Bay Area, driving 10 miles was nothing.
Right, right.
And here I looked at 10 miles. That's nothing.
Yeah, yeah.
So
it was really nothing in your scope, in your world, and whatever. And so then, now, what about the need for some cash flow? Like the girls, were they trained? Did they have an opportunity to go to work?
I don't think they had jobs at that time. One, she said, no, this isn't for her. And she went back to the States, joined the military, and became a helicopter mechanic.
Okay.
Down
okay.
in Georgia.
Right.
And so one stayed here. I kind of lost my train of thought here.
Well, it's okay because we're just sort of trying to figure out. What I always try to wonder about is how do we eat? And so
the first job I got was at the training center, the old experimental farm.
Right, right.
And I would stay there 4 days straight at night and... So I was putting in maybe 100 hours a month, and I get paid $100. So I was working for $1 an hour.
Right, right, right.
Not going to get rich.
Well, the nice thing about the experimental farm is they had a cooking center there, too, and they would also feed you. Did you get a part of that?
Yeah, we did that. I ran the woodworking shop.
Right, right.
And it was kind of a counselor.
Yeah.
It was an okay job, but, you know, $1 an hour.
That's pretty pretty
low. You couldn't go down much lower.
Yeah. But when I got on at Endako Mines in the same period of time, I was making $2.35 an hour as an apprentice mechanic.
Geez, you weren't much more over me.
That's right, right. So the wages were low in that era.
But the jobs were available.
Yeah. Yeah, there was an opportunity, certainly a big opportunity in the early 70s to find work. And what I liked about it was that there was, you know, if you wanted to become a tradesperson or some type of career, it was available. You didn't have to go to Timbuktu to get started. There was enough. I kind of visualize it a little bit today. There's a lot of work around today.
Yeah,
and so if you want a job, you should be able to find a job, you know?
Well, one guy offered me a job to learn how to pound a 6-inch steel tube down into the ground to go get water.
Right.
And so I worked with him for a week. I was bored out of my mind, this thing.
Right, you know, right, right.
And I said, thanks, but I'm going to turn you down. I can't go after this job.
Right.
He promised me a rig if I stayed with him.
Yeah.
But I just couldn't do it.
Exactly, exactly. Well, Tobe, let's, part of our program is we like to have a little bit of a playlist, and you've chosen a few songs that kind of fit that, and this first song is sort of a little bit of that era of time. Was there any particular reason you chose this? This is the Buffalo Springfield song?
Oh, For What It's Worth?
Yeah.
Well, it spoke to me pretty much that you had to kind of watch what you were doing, because the police were, they had microphones in the parks, and they would record what you were saying, and if it was too reactionary, they'd send the police out and they'd arrest you.
Yeah, yeah. So it's definitely an era song, and when I was building the playlist, I listened to it a couple of times. I looked it up. That is actually Stephen Stills, and he's actually from Winnipeg.
Oh.
Like Neil Young and him got together in Winnipeg before they went down to L.A. and started recording down there. So let's give it a go and see how it sounds, and we'll see if we can get her fired up here.
There's something happening here, but what it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there, telling me I got to beware. I think it's time we stop, children, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. Battle lines being drawn. Nobody's right if everybody's wrong. Young people speaking their minds are getting so much resistance from behind. Time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. What a field day for the heat. A thousand people in the street, singing songs and carrying signs, mostly say hooray for our side. It's time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. Strikes deep into your life, it will creep. It starts when you're always afraid. Step out of line, the man come and take you away. We better stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going on. We better stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going on. We better stop. Now, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going. We better stop. Children, what's that sound?
Boy, they sure don't write them like that.
Oh, man, that is a seriously amazing song. It truly is.
What I liked, there was one line in there. Everybody was carrying signs saying, hooray for our side.
Yeah.
And that spoke a lot to me.
Yeah. Well, it was quite a time.
With all the demonstrations, the war, everything.
Yeah. I kind of, this is where I'm sort of feeling like I watched a demonstration they had the other day with Bernie Sanders and trying to get people to kind of realize what's going on with the Trump administration and the power that they are gathering together and refusing. They're refusing to listen to the courts. They're trying to take sort of, to me, it looks like it's a Putin playbook is what's happening. And I'm kind of concerned about that.
But then the states, I don't think, you don't see a lot of the demonstrations like you saw back then in the Vietnam War.
No.
And I just don't think they've woken up to the fact
of
what's coming down the pipe out of
it. Yeah. I think it's gonna be a growth thing as it seems to get tighter and tighter.
Yeah.
Right now, the administration has sent a delegation to Greenland, and it's kind of like, at this time in our history, that a country would be wanting to advance over another country, it doesn't really make a lot of sense.
They have the biggest deposit of rare earth minerals there.
In the world.
Yeah.
And
so it's for TVs, cell phones, other things that they could do with the rare earth. And so, like, it's lucrative.
Right. No, it's certainly, I mean, but we would normally, we would negotiate and we would buy and we would trade, but we wouldn't take over.
Normally.
Yeah. Okay, Tope, so let's go back a little bit more now. We're going to move along from the Hudson Bay Mountain. Now, did this woman that remained, did you end up marrying her?
No, we just lived together.
But you were friends. You were partners,
yes,
whatever. And so is she still your partner?
No. That lasted a couple of years. And so she went her way and I went mine.
Right. And did she stay in Canada?
Yeah, she's still in kind of the extended valley.
Okay, all right. So she kind of got attached to it and decided to hang around.
She made Canada her home.
Yeah, that's very nice. And so what about yourself? Like, you're up on this part of the community. You're up Hudson Bay Mountain Road. How did you get yourself to the Kitsiukla area?
I was working with forestry and as a fire lookout. And so before the snows left the alpine areas, we would take care of the wreck sites. And one of them, the wreck site was out in the Kitsiuk Lake Valley, and I saw this one piece of property was for sale. And so I went and found the guy in town, and I had done a job for him, reskirting his house.
Right.
And in the middle of the job, his wife came out and said, we can't pay you.
Right.
I said, why? And so she said, well, my husband had a heart attack.
Oh, son of a gun.
And so they expected him to die. And I said, well, do you have the materials? And so she said, yes. So my buddy and I, we finished up the job. And I said, pay me when you can. I paid my buddy off. Well, here it is. A couple of years later, the guy lived. And he was well disposed towards me. So his property up there in Kitsiuk Lake Road was for sale. And he said, okay, I'll sell it to you. And it was a 12-year lease. And they were 2 years left on the lease. So I bought the option.
I see.
And I met the requirements. And so I was able to buy the property for $100 an acre from the government.
I see.
So it was. That's the way land was. I mean, I could afford that.
Right. It must have been fortunate that you were working for forestry at the time, so you had a little bit of understanding of the process.
No, that didn't help at all.
It didn't help. So nobody was in their organization, like
and
whatever.
They were following the letter of the law, and I met the requirements. I had dibs on the land because I had bought the option.
Right.
And so they sold me the land, and that was it.
Right.
Pretty straightforward.
Right. So just to backpedal a little bit, how did you get on at forestry? Like, was that an easy...
Well, I needed a job.
Yeah.
And so I applied for a lighthouse keeper and for a lookout.
Hmm.
And the lighthouse keeper, it just... it didn't come through. Eventually it came through, but it was too late.
Right.
And so I went in there and I said, I want to be a lookout. So the guy would say, well, you know, we have to hire somebody that is neat because we don't want them getting sick up there. And I said, I'm fastidiously clean.
Right.
And they said, well, what are you going to do with your time up there? You know, you got to be your own entertainment. And I said, I'm extremely creative. And they said, how's your eyesight? And I said, perfect.
Right.
He said, well, that we can test. So we went out into the yard, and they had a 8x8 piece of board that was painted white, and there was a dot the size of a freckle up in one of the corners. And so the guy would spin it, and I was 60 feet away, and he said, what corner?
No kidding.
And
no
so
kidding.
I got it 3 out of 3.
Right,
and
right.
He came back in, and so the boss said, well, how's his eyesight? And he said, perfect.
Yeah, yeah.
So I had the job.
Oh, that sounds good. That almost sounds like a sobriety test that the police would give you when you're walking on a down a line, and this thing is turning the board and finding the freckle. Yeah.
Well, if you didn't have good eyesight, you weren't
going
to
see
it.
You would never see it. No, that's for sure. That's for sure. So that job as the lookout person, there must have been other lookout people that you met while you were in that?
Yeah, they one was on Old Fort. Another one was on Parrot. That was out of Houston. There was another lookout on Cronin and another Smithers lookout on Horetsky.
On where?
Horetsky. It's kind of at the mouth of the Babine River or
mouth
of the Babine Lake. And so we could all talk to each other over the radio at night. And then we'd get together at the end of the season and swap stories of what it was like being up there for 90 days by yourself.
Wow, 90 days. That's a pretty good stretch. That's a pretty good stretch.
It went by amazingly fast.
Yeah. So was there, they supplied you with enough food?
They would fly up every 2 weeks with water, food order that we had called down, and mail. And
right.
We'd give them mail, you know, our letters to go out, with our empty water containers, and we'd talk over the whine of the jet engine.
Right.
And then in 10 minutes, they'd be gone.
Yeah.
And they'd be back in another 2 weeks.
So when you were on the job, like, how did you determine your hourly period of work? Like, did you work 24/7?
Well, they sort of expected it. I mean, sun up to sun down, and if there was a lightning strike or a lightning storm that went through at night, you were expected to be up. And so you'd watch where the strikes were coming, and you'd mark it on your fire finder what the what the degree was. And then you would look down there in that area for the next 4 days and to see if any smoke would come up.
Right, right. So that would give you an idea of where there could be a problem.
Sometimes it took that long for it to build up to see the smoke.
Right, right. I see. So in that career, did you see a lot of fires?
I was in the valley that I live in now, and it was pretty quiet, but I did spot a number of fires there.
Right.
And the dog I had up there was able to spot one, too.
Right, right, yeah, right, so, yeah.
So I worked on Cronin, and there were more fires there.
In that area,
yeah.
Cronin right now, they put a new trail into. It's kind of like a wreck site now up there.
Ah.
And they've got a new trail coming off Chapman Lake that they've just put in last year.
I heard that they tore the lookout down.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's interesting, Toby. And so how did you manage your time? Like, it's pretty easy. When I was, the first job I had, I was working on a farm, and they said to me, well, we're going to make silage, and we're going to bring in the hay, and we're going to dump it in this pit. And you drive back and forth.
Oh, packing it down.
Pack it down. And I couldn't stay awake. And so they warned me and warned me. And by the end of the month, they let me go. Because I just couldn't do a job that didn't have sort of some activity to keep my blood flowing. But in your case, you're watching, you're studying, but there must be downtime where you have to fill your...
Every anytime I moved, I would look around.
Yeah.
And you move lots throughout the day. So I would be painting the lookout. I'd be screwing down the roof if I needed to.
Right, right.
There was always something to do there.
And what about animal encounters? Did you have any of those?
At the one on Hankin, there was a grizzly bear that came up, and to the dog's credit, he did not chase after it or start barking at it. And I marked it between two bushes, and it was on the helipad there, and I went over and measured it. And when it was on all fours, it measured 8 feet from nose to tail and 4 foot high at the shoulders.
Right.
And
right.
It was like a stretched limo. There was 2 foot section of bear put in there to make it long. And he knew I was there then, and I knew he was there, and we never saw each other again.
Right, right. Well, you know, there's something to be said with animals if you're not really trying to shoot them, that maybe they can sort of put up with you.
Also, since, why pick a fight? Because if you got injured, that would be it.
Yeah, yeah.
For both of us.
Yeah. You could have, you could be in serious trouble, but you would have radio connection with your base.
Might be a little bit late. But
right, right. You may have bled out, but hopefully not. Well, that's interesting. Okay, well, Toby, let's slide in one more song here. This one here is your next playlist song. It's called My Best Friend by Jefferson Airplane. Was there any reason you chose that song, say, over White Rabbit or another?
I thought the whole album was the best.
Yeah, yeah.
It was about the best I heard back then. Everything on the album was
pretty special.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that seems like it was one of their sort of main albums that was successful, and there was a lot of projects that didn't go as well in their future.
Yeah.
You know, it's quite a read on some of these Spotify songs of the history of the artist, you know? So anyways, let's give it a go here and see what we've got.
Are you my best friend?
You are my best friend.
I love you so well.
To the
end of time, you won't see me. Are you my best friend?
You are my best friend.
I see you, it seems. Now I can see I've fallen into your love stream. I'll follow your dream. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. I'll follow you wherever time will take me to. Forever I'll be one with you.
One with you.
Do you know what I mean?
right. Okay, I've got to leave you now. It's good, but we're going to just carry on. And I'll try again maybe on the next song. That's a lovely little song. My best friend, that you, was it related to a best friend or just the music itself?
Back then, when I was younger, relationships were intense, and I didn't always do the best. I think I got better at it the older I got. But, learning how to be a best friend.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, a good friend, a best friend is a dog. And that dog that you lived with.
Yeah, well, I got a best friend now, and that's a dog.
Yeah, exactly. That's a good connection that you have there with your dog on the job. Tobe, we've come to the midway point of the show, so at this point, I like to have a station identification
to
remind the listeners that we are Smithers Community Radio, and this is CICK. 93.9 on your FM dial. Now, we have a shout-out to our sponsors. I've got them up on the wall there that are helping us, being that we're a volunteer organization and we don't have any direct money coming in, but the sponsors are giving us some assistance. So I usually like to call out a little bit to what we have. We've got, right at the moment, we've got... our appreciation tonight to Out of Hand, downtown Smithers, the BV Concert Association, Classic Sanitary, the Community Radio Fund, and BV Farmers Market. So I just remind our listeners that my name is Thomas Tom Roper, and we are tonight... Our program is On the Ropes, and we have with us our guest from the Kitsiukla area, Toby Walsh. So, Toby, one of the next things that I kind of think is sort of cool about your program is the shoe. How did that come? Like, you sort of found this property, and the property had something on it, did it?
Yeah, there was a trailer. And I had to put a permanent foundation under it. And once that was done, I was stuck with the thing.
Yeah.
So the walls were an inch and a half thick. First winter, I froze.
I can imagine. I can imagine.
So the roof leaked.
Right.
And it was sort of trashed inside. So I thickened the walls to 8 inches. The roof... Well, I was going to need another roof, and the trailer was small. I decided to build up, and then I was afraid that the up part was going to blow over in a windstorm. So I angled the roof up to anchor the upstairs, and so I had my boot. It looked like a steel-toed boot.
So that wasn't something you said to yourself, I'm making a shoe boot. I'm just going to, you start building, and then all of a sudden it formed into what you thought, hey,
well,
this looks kind of cool.
It was either going to be a rocket or a shoe.
Right.
And I thought it would be kind of funny to build a rocket and have ICBM written on it, like Intercontinental Ballistic Missile.
That might get you in trouble.
I was going to take a picture of it and send it to Moscow saying, guess where?
I was
afraid they were going to send me a satellite photo with an X saying, here. And I figured, this isn't going to sit well with the community.
Yeah.
So I figured I'd go with a boot instead.
That sounds like probably a better decision because
so
you don't want to bring problems. We got enough problems without encouraging those that are not happy. So this shoe, then, like I recall it, like I came here a year after you. I was in 73, and I must have come up to the shoe, I would say maybe 75, maybe 76, but there was sort of a steady process of people coming out to take pictures.
Yeah, there was. Now, when I built this thing, I didn't think people would come on out to see it.
Right.
You know, it was just kind of a thing that I just enjoyed doing. But once it was built, I started getting some interesting people stopping in. One was a Tibetan Buddhist monk, and he was tired that day, so he was a grouchy monk.
Right, right.
And he was sixth in line to the Dalai Lama.
Okay, all right. And what's he doing in Smithers, British Columbia?
He was drumming up support for getting back Tibet from the Chinese.
Right.
And then there was another guy that came through. He was a Moroccan vacuum cleaner salesman.
Right, right.
And his dad was the head of agriculture in Morocco, gave him $100,000 to go see the world. He went broke in Canada.
Wow.
And married a woman in Vancouver, started selling vacuum cleaners, had a couple of kids. And so he wanted to take the whole family back to Morocco to show his mom and dad. Well, she didn't like traveling. She hadn't even been out of Vancouver city limits.
Right, right.
So we talked about what it was like coming to Canada. And,
mm-hmm.
and he was just distraught that his wife didn't want to travel. He didn't sell a vacuum cleaner. And so I don't even think I had power then.
Yeah.
So so he couldn't have sold me a vacuum cleaner anyway.
Right, 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 yeah. So with this house being built, you're meeting different people. It's kind of almost a social situation for you, where you, being that you're living out in the bush, and then all of a sudden somebody be knocking on the door or trying to phone you or whatever.
And they would tell me their stories.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, remember like back in the time of like Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid?
Right.
They had the Pinkertons going after him.
Yeah, yeah.
And there was one guy, he was still working for Pinkertons,
mm-hmm.
and he showed up at the house, and I was surprised the Pinkertons were still...
Was still going.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, well, they actually, in that story about Simon Gunnanoot out of Hazleton, that was in the 20s, 30s, there was Pinkertons looking for him.
Okay.
And he was off. I just finished a book about an American couple that were living north of Takla Lake. It's a really interesting story. And they were and Simon had passed through their area a few times, you know. And they were the police were looking for them because there was this murder in Hazleton that had to be cleaned up. And they managed to stay out in the bush for 13 years, which is pretty amazing. Pretty amazing. But in your case, Tobe, now this, I think when I got out there, I had a couple of kids with me, and I asked you if we could have a tour, and you just took us in like there was no question that you were showing your place off, and I was kind of impressed with that, you know? I could have been the type of guy that it's kind of like, well, no, I don't think so. You have to call. You've got to make an appointment.
No, you know? Not that formal out there.
Yeah, yeah.
That's I think it. If people wanted to come out and they like the looks of the shoe.
Yeah.
I mean, how could you be hard-nosed about that?
Yeah, yeah. No, that's pretty cool, I think. So that we're rolling along pretty good on the program here, and it doesn't take long, you know, when we put a few songs in there to get ourselves to the end. So we're looking good. Let's slide another song in.
Okay, which one is this
time? And
we
got this next one you've got is one of my favorites. Like we did, we always like to have a Canadian as part of our CRTC regulations. You chose Neil Young, one of my favorites. And this song, Old Man, was there any reason? Is the old man related to Santa Claus or anything?
No. I'm an old man.
Okay.
Yeah, like I'm going to be 80 next month.
80?
80.
Good for you. I think that's an accomplishment.
I thought so, too.
Yeah. I think to make our way through our age program, it's amazing that we've been able to achieve that. And that's what the confusing part that I'm having with the American government right now is we've gone like 50, 60 years without having problems, and then all of a sudden these problems have come up, and the whole program is going to change on us. It's kind of strange. But let's not go too deep into it. Let's take a run at this song.
Yeah.
my life, I'm a lot like you were. Old man, look at my life, 24 and there's so much more. Live alone in a paradise that makes me think of two. Love lost, such a cost. Give me things that don't get lost, like a coin that won't get tossed, rolling home to you.
I sure like the music that, you know, that came about when I was younger. I identify with it strongly.
Yeah, and I can't, you know, I mean, it's...
And I'm sure the people that are in the same age category I was, that they are in now, I would think they probably identify with that music for probably the rest of their life.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, it can't be any different than... People today, like young people today, are going to find the music that they identify with, and they're going to carry that through. Like I was talking to a guy, and he's turning 50. So he's 30 years younger than us. He's got his music is in a different era, but that's what he wants to listen to rather than what is coming out of the radio today, like, say, new music, you know. So we get our own sort of connection that we like with the music, and I think it's good. So a lot of our songs are still sort of important today for people to listen to, and some people do, you know.
Yeah.
So, Tobe, we're getting close on our run here, and we want there's a couple more things I want to check with you. Now, how did you get yourself involved in traveling? Like, well, what did you, were your parents big travelers?
No, they were homebodies.
Homebodies. So
the fire lookout job ended. They found they could do it with airplane, road traffic. And so I needed another job, and I already had my degree. So I went one more year, and I got my teaching certificate.
Okay. I didn't know that. Did you get that here in Canada?
In Prince George.
Okay.
Through SFU.
Right.
And so my first job was up on Baffin Island, in a place called Clyde River. So my wife then, she headed the clinic, and I taught grade 5.
What a perfect setup.
Yeah, because like they could put two people into one house.
Right, exactly. And housing was, exactly. And she's providing something for the community as you were.
Yeah.
You know, so that's pretty
so
cool.
So that got the movement. And so we came up with the thing, every 5 years, we would force a move.
Yes.
And so when the 5 years was up, we went to China to go learn Chinese. And I figured if we could make it in China, we could make it anywhere in the world.
Exactly. Exactly.
And we learned about 200 words.
That's pretty amazing. That's pretty amazing.
And so then the next move was to the Western Arctic, and I did adult ed there. And let's see, where do we go then? Oh, for our honeymoon, we went down to Guatemala.
Right.
And we were down there between coups.
Exactly.
And we were learning Spanish down there.
Right.
And so,
your linguistic skills are pretty good.
No, they're
pretty
terrible.
Good.
They're terrible.
Right, right.
I didn't manage to learn much of any of the languages. So then when we were over in the Middle East, it was another teaching job in Kuwait, and I tried Arabic with this one guy, Khalid, and he was teaching at the university. And I struggle with this.
Oh.
And so he said, you know, he says, I like you. You're a good guy. But he said, I always thought I was a pretty good teacher until you showed up in my class.
Right.
So he asked me, please don't take any more classes.
Right, right. Yeah, exactly. So, well, talk about a difficult language. It's kind of unbelievable. When I was in the Sahara, the greatest word was labeth. I don't know if you heard that in your where you were going through.
What's it mean?
Labeth kind of means like, how are you doing?
How's
your mother? What's going on? You know, it's kind of a very casual, friendly word. And you could just kind of almost repeat it. And you were making some type of communication. Salam alaikum. Alaikum salam.
Oh, okay, that's...
And then you would go with labeth, and then you would have a bit of a conversation, even though you didn't know what they were saying back to you. You were sort of involved in it. Kuwait, you were in, like when you're saying on these trips, you were in China for 5 years?
No, just China for a couple of months.
Right, and then Kuwait, you were in there for 5 years?
4 years.
That's a long period of time to commit.
Well, I was teaching at the high school here, and I said that I've got a teaching position in Kuwait.
Wow.
And they said, well, we'll hold your job for you. And I said, well, if it's still good after the first year, we're going to do a second year. And if it's still good, then we're going to run with it.
Yeah.
And then they wouldn't hold my job anymore. So it was 4 years in Kuwait and then 5 years in Oman.
Oh, in the same area.
Yeah.
Wow. So you've got a little connection with the...
Arabs and I got along really well.
Yeah.
People would ask my wife, well, weren't you afraid of being over there? So she said, no, she felt comfortable being by herself, walking around anywhere in Oman, day or night.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't even say that about BC.
No.
They were saying it just didn't compute that it was safer than what we have here at home. And she said, yeah.
Hmm. Very interesting. Well, Tobe, we're pushing the envelope here, and there is one thing that I really wanted to play, and that is this little clip of Al Jolson. I don't know how you came up with it and why.
I read about it, and you wanted something obscure. Well, this is about as obscure as I could find.
I just can't believe how obscure it is. Let's give it a run.
Peter and for Mrs. Rip Van Winkle, when Rip Van Winkle went away. And while he slept for 20 years, who was it kissed away her tears? She had no friends in the place, no one to embrace, but the landlord always loved her with a smile on his face. Who paid rent for Mrs. Rip Van Winkle, when Rip Van Winkle went away?
Wow.
Obscure?
That is totally obscure. That's a pretty cool one. So it looks like we're going to miss out on your fourth song, The Beach Boys. And The Beach Boys is kind of one of my old-time favorite groups. I actually was speaking with my brother the other day. He plays music in L.A. He lives in L.A. And he knows this guy that's still working for The Beach Boys. And this guy is a drummer with the band. And he looks after Al, I think it's Al Jardine. And Al is now, 80, 82, 83, 84, and he's getting a little bit doddery, and so they kind of keep him hanging on in the band, but, he's sort of got to be helped through in a lot of things. But anyways, they're still going. We're talking 60 years for those Beach Boys, That's pretty crazy.
Look at the Rolling Stones.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, they're going to be skeletons up there, and they'll probably still be going.
Yeah, yeah. They'll make it right to the end. So, Toby, I'd really like to thank you for coming by and letting us interview and get a little bit more information about your life and help the listeners understand a little bit if they ever get a chance to come out and see the shoe. They'll have sort of got a little bit of history of you. And so we're going to close her up. We have a little outro, and then we'll make our time. There you are. We're already 45 seconds over.
Uh-oh.
But we're going to do her. So thanks very much, Tobe.
Well, thank you for having me here.
It's been fun. Let's try this now and see if we can get her going.
You have been listening to On the Ropes, Smithers Community Radio, CICK 93.9 on your FM dial. I'm your host, Thomas Tom Roper, and we will see you on the flip side.